Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of the world's best resource for hockey strength and conditioning information. HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 61 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. Today we are going to be doing something a little bit different. My name is Brian Sippett. I'm actually sitting here in my teeny tiny office with Daryl Nelson, who is the strength and conditioning coach for the National Team Development Program in Plymouth, Michigan. So I'm here with Daryl. We see each other quite often. As you guys know, we are co-owners of the site, HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com. If you haven't checked it out, you can check it out for a buck for the first 7 days. You can go on there, you can check out programs, articles, webinars. The podcasts, of course, are always free, but join us for 7 days for just a buck and check out all the great content we have there. We're updating weekly. So anything, if you train hockey players, you'll get a ton of great information out of the website. Check it out if you haven't already. If you're not a member, you should join us and get all that great content all year round. So I'm here with Daryl today. We decided not to do a phone interview this week, but we were together and we decided we'd just hook up and talk about what's going on with the national program. Daryl has also been taking a PRI course, or is finishing up his second PRI course, so we're going to talk a little bit about that. So, Daryl, thanks for cramming in my teeny office here.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, so we see each other kind of often, so we'll just sort of recreate some of the conversations that we have, but talk to us a little bit about where you are in this season with the national team and where, you know, what the goal is for this time of year.
Well, where we're at, you know, the second week in November is international break, so both teams had international tournaments, so basically we're just getting back on our feet with regular practice and regular training from that. So our goal, you know, early in the fall before that, more practice and training intensive. You know, the first few weeks of the year we don't have as many games. We only play one game weekends usually instead of two game weekends, so more practice days, more training days. Building up for that tournament, then coming out of that tournament, you know, the tournament's 4 or 5 games in a week, you know, and then the guys return, come back from wherever they were, Finland or Russia or Canada or wherever they happen to be, depending on the year and the team. And so now we're, you know, basically only a couple weeks going into Christmas break where the guys will have time off. So we're you know, two games every weekend at this point, basically for the rest of the year. So gives us less training days and less practice days, so we're really getting into more of what you would typically think of as an in-season training mode, 2 days per week strength and conditioning program.
And so how do you find, coming off of the international tournament and things like that, how do you find, are the guys, like, energized when they get back? Is it starting to grind on them a little bit? How do they look in the weight room and in practice?
You know, they look good. I think those international competitions, you know, like our U17 team won the under-17 challenge this year, which is in British Columbia, and so it's always great to win. And so I think they're kind of energized by that. Generally speaking, you know, a few days, a few extra days off coming back, you know, as time changes and all those kinds of things, get caught up at school, and then we kind of have a little bit of a push going into, you know, Christmas, knowing that we're going to have like a week off. You know, the U17 team still has another international tournament before Christmas break here in December. So that's, you know, that's something to keep in mind, but we just keep building for that, knowing that we're going to have that break. And so that break at Christmas time is our time off. That's our chance to get re-energized. That's our time to recoup. So we don't want to stop ahead of that and stop making progress and then have the time off and then try to come back in January and February. We want to push through that and then have the time off at Christmas.
And so how do you approach off-ice training right now in terms of, you know, you did mention that they're on in-season schedule, they're lifting twice a week. What's the focus right now for them in terms of, you know, you got the break coming up, are you pushing a little bit? What's the focus right now in the weight room? And how does that change once they get back from break?
Yeah, so the focus really is, as I would say, the lifting doesn't really change. I think what changes is just how much we do. You know, we're down to 2 days a week, and you're really in season, pretty much all we do is foam roll, stretch, and strength training. We're not doing plyometrics, we're not doing any running, we're not doing any biking, any of those extra things. Just the strength training, 2 days a week. So the workouts are, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, as opposed to an hour and 45 minute off-season workout. because we're not doing all the extra stuff. We're not running, we're not jumping, we're not biking, we're not sprinting, we're not whatever the case may be. But as far as the lifting goes, we're still trying to build. We still want to make gains in lean mass. We still want to make gains in power and explosive ability. And of course, we're always trying to do things, foam rollers and stretching and corrective exercise to try to maintain, any postural things or avoid any injuries, reduce any injuries as much as possible.
Let's go back a little bit. Let's talk about kind of taking a majority of the power work out of the workouts and just focusing on the strength training. I know we do similar things here, and I've always kind of been under the impression that they get the power work on the ice. As a coach, you kind of see what happens on the ice. There's a lot of, obviously, dynamic movement during practice. Is that your reasoning for taking it out, or what's the logic behind taking it out of the programs when you work so hard to develop it in the off season?
Yeah, we're not necessarily taking it out. Like, we're still throwing medicine balls once a week for core work, and we're still doing Olympic-style lifting, along with squatting and pull-ups and all that kind of stuff and pressing. So, we're not really taking it out. We're just reducing the volume. And again, like you said, like, I'm looking at it from a standpoint of what are we not getting on the ice? Well, we don't lift heavy weights on the ice. We don't stretch on the ice. We don't get soft tissue work on the ice. As far as like doing short sprints or plyometrics or the more dynamic body weight type stuff, we do that on the ice every day. That's what hockey is. Hockey is plyometric. Hockey is short sprints. Hockey is cardiovascular training. So I'm, from my standpoint, the strength and conditioning program is what boxes are getting checked off on the ice. That's what I'm going to do in the weight room.
That makes sense.
And I think that's where a lot of people go wrong. In season, they want to do circuits and stuff like that, and they're doing things that are redundant off the ice, and they're not getting the things that they're not getting in the on-ice practice. They're not being holistic in their approach, I guess. They're not trying to fill every box.
Got it. Yeah, it goes back to that bucket idea of what do you need to be an athlete, and what are you not getting right now? Yeah.
Right.
This is actually something we haven't talked about. I know that there are studies going on and that there is a lot of technology being used on the players, and I think most of it is for USA Hockey in terms of just gathering data. Do you have access to any of that? I know it's an outside study that's going on. Do you have any access to the data, and do you use that at all?
We've seen the data a little bit. The researchers have presented a few times to the coaching staff on what they've collected so far. It's a 3-year study. We're a year and a half in, so it's halfway done. And I think the data, really all the monitoring stuff, honestly, my experience with it so far, in my opinion, is that it's a great way to quantify what happens on the ice, and I don't think it's really great to quantify what happens in the weight room. Again, when you're talking about loading somebody with external weights and building strength and power and those things. So the monitoring device measures your accelerations, it measures your respiration, it measures your heart rate, it measures your body temperature, all that. So you can see, like, it really, in a really simplistic way, what the numbers are telling you. If someone has high accelerations and low heart rate, it means they're well rested. If someone's accelerations decrease and their heart rate is increasing, it means they're fatigued. They're working harder and they're getting less output. So what that gives you is that's a way to monitor fatigue level and readiness on a big scale on a long term. And I think that is a great tool, and I think it's helped the coaches, come to some decisions. Like, one thing we change a lot is if we have a game on Saturday night, we don't do a morning skate on Saturday anymore. Pre-game skate's gone away, because that really significantly increases fatigue in the game. So that's something that the coaches have taken out. We don't do pre-game skates.
Period?
No. No, they haven't been doing any this year.
Interesting.
That's a real cultural thing in hockey, and I think a lot of people won't change it. Even if they hear this and they look at some numbers and stuff, they'll say, oh, that's bullshit, whatever, we're doing it. And, the pregame skate, guys go out, and it helps them feel better on their first shift because they already did something that day. And then the rest of the game, they're tense because they accumulate fatigue. So my opinion is what we really should be doing is not doing the pregame skate at 10 or 11 in the morning, but before the game at 7 o'clock at night, we'd be doing a more intense warm-up so that the guys really get neuromuscularly and cardiovascularly, they get going before the puck drops. Don't do such a nonchalant warm-ups. Do stuff at game speed in warm-ups. you know, and the guys will feel better in their first couple shifts.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I agree with 100%. Having been in that situation, pregame skate does help you sort of get in the game day routine and everything. But because we always did it, basically, you never know if it was adding to fatigue or if that's just how you feel. So, well, that's interesting that you can quantify that. Are you using it for any on-the-fly judgments in terms of, you know, I know a lot of places will use readiness to sort of say, okay, this is what you're going to do today. Do you make any judgments on the fly, or do you find that the coaches manage things pretty well?
The coaches really haven't done that, and I think for the most part, our coaches manage the players' energy pretty well. Like this week, for example, you know, we were just coming back from Thanksgiving break from school, but the guys had games, and actually both coaches decided to just take Monday off. They didn't skate, we didn't lift, we just moved everything back to Tuesday this week. But I'm not so sure that was based on the monitoring data. I just think it was based on what they observed. Or just like, you know, the travel was long and the games were tough, and you know, the week before that was the international competition, so they just kind of said, "F it, I'm gonna take the extra day off." So they do make on the fly decisions with or without the monitoring information. And I think for the most part, our coaches have been really good at managing the players' energy. And I think when we practice, they want to do everything at game speed. So they would rather practice for 45 minutes really hard and then just scrap it and say the rest of practice, you know, we're starting to suck now, so we're just not going to practice anymore. Or they're always, my experience has always been with the last 5 or 6 coaches that we've had, is that the coaches are very willing to say, yep, you know what, we had games, we had practice, we had this, we had that, we're not skating, we're just going to lift today. And so that's, you know, a lot of coaches would be the other way around. Well, guys are a little bit tired, so we're not going to lift. We're just going to go out and skate. Well, you just played a tournament where you had 5 games in 7 days, and you haven't seen the weight room in 10 days. You know, it's not really, again, going back to the idea of filling buckets and checking off all your things that you want to have, that you want to accomplish. That's the backward way of doing it. And our coaches have been pretty good about that.
And so like you said in the beginning, I think people are finding that the technology just helps to quantify judgment calls that a lot of good coaches are already making.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, but the coaches that are the most into using the monitoring data are the ones that need it the least. It changes what they would do the least. And the ones that are in the most need of it are the ones that are the most reluctant to use it and to embrace the new ideas. You know, it's like our coaches, you know, it was like last year when John Robleski was not coaching the under-18 team, the 99s. Like, that was one of the first things that they found out was like, yeah, these pregame skates are starting to suck, and he was willing to change right away. You know, there's not a lot of coaches out there, I think, that would be willing to make a change on the fly like that. But he's like, yeah, you know, we're right, because we're looking at the monitoring data, and you go back and you look at that game, and he's like, yeah, you know what, you're right. We played like crap in that game. The guys just looked terrible. It looked like we were skating in sand. And so they've been, you know, they've been pretty into it, and that's obviously different with every single hockey coach, but they're willing to adapt quickly.
Yeah, it seems like every argument sort of, at least with us, sort of points in the direction of using a technology. So I didn't really mean to get into that, but I sort of remembered that was going on, and we hadn't talked about that.
I think it's great, and I think one thing we're doing is that we're trying to make it a strength and conditioning issue, and it's really for the sport coach more. It really impacts what they do a lot more.
Yeah.
And even just in the daily goings-on of things, the coach ultimately is the one that makes the schedule. Whether it's strength training or on-ice practice or whatever else they're going to do, it's up to the coach to make those decisions. And so if the coach isn't bought in, then it's really going to be limited as to what a strength and conditioning coach is going to do with that data. And also, I think the volume of data you get when you're monitoring 45 guys, a strength and conditioning coach couldn't do it. You can't do all of that. You can't filter through all of that in a day. There's not enough hours in the day.
Well, there's the group that's running the project has an entire team. They even had to hire out a team of statisticians to tease out all the information.
Yeah, they have three or four grad students plus the physiologist, and they're all putting in, I think, like 4 to 6 hours a day on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of hours.
Let's transition away from this a little bit, and talk about what you're up to right now. You're always learning, you're always reading, and one of the most recent things you're kind of checking off your list is your second PRI course. Talk to us a little bit about that, how the first one went, what you learned from the first one, and why you attacked the second one.
Yeah, so the second one, what I'm doing right now, is the postural restoration course. And I really like the PRI stuff. I think it's great. It's very physical therapist driven and centric, obviously, and I'm not a physical therapist, so I don't have a lot of experience or really any experience with a lot of the testing and the manual therapy. But I still really like it. I encourage people to still take the course. You know, the one thing, whether it's functional movement screen or PRI, whatever it is, the one thing with physical therapists that you have to keep in mind, or the, not the physical therapist, but that philosophy of stuff, is that they work with one person at a time, not 22 at a time. So, I mean, you have to be willing to take the ideas that you get from it and be able to adapt it to a group setting. There's, you know, there's some things you can't do manual testing on 22 guys every day, obviously. But with that being said, you know, the idea and the general trend and what you can see and what you can find in your players when you know what to look for, it can be pretty revealing. And it, I think a big part of it, it helps you know what not to do. When you see what kind of patterns people are falling into, you can try to avoid exercises that reinforce those bad patterns as much as anything else. That's what I've taken away from it. So the first course I did was the myokinematic course. And the second course that I've done is the pelvic restoration course. But basically, to kind of sum it up, the idea behind PRI is that what you learn in your anatomy class or in the textbook isn't really that accurate, because human beings are not symmetrical. And whenever you look at anatomy textbooks, all the pictures and all the diagrams are all symmetrical, and they show that as being the ideal. And that's really not true. Humans aren't symmetrical. You know, so the left side of your brain is typically more developed than the right side. And in your torso, you have a heart on one side and a liver on the other side. And generally, if your left brain is more developed, most people, about 90% of people, are right-handed. They're right-hand dominant. People that are right-hand dominant are left-leg dominant. But so with that being said, human beings, so the idea is that human beings work in alternating and reciprocal patterns. And that is so that the asymmetry in the different systems, the neurological system, the cardiovascular system, the muscular system, the digestive system, play against each other to create balance and symmetry. So what happens when you get a faulty movement pattern, the systems aren't playing off each other. And so that's what causes a lot of the chronic issues that we see. And so, like the pelvic restoration thing, a lot of it was about pelvic floor. And a lot of people say, well, I don't do anything with the pelvic floor. Well, if you have people that have knee pain or back pain or all this stuff with FAI and sports hernias, SI joint dysfunction, then you work with the pelvic floor, you know, whether you realize it or not. You know, and we've talked about this before, and I presented on it last year to clinic, this posture we see with hockey players where everybody has a lot of anterior pelvic tilt. That's actually, caused by this asymmetry where someone develops a faulty pattern of movement because they're not properly compensating for this asymmetry. It's a posterior exterior chain pattern that we see in the PRI stuff is a big part of what the course is about, and that's what a lot of these hockey players are pushed into. They're tilted forward on both sides of their pelvis. They have pelvic floor and hamstrings that are way too long and too loose, abdominal muscles that are too long and too loose and too thin. And so that's really a big part of what the course is about how to get other things to fire and some things to be inhibited so that you can facilitate, the correct posture. So I find it really interesting and really fascinating because you see those patterns and it's like, yeah, every guy I have on my team has that.
Right.
You know, almost every good hockey player has that pattern.
Yeah.
You know, and so anyway, they just talk about those things and what some of the corrective things are that you can do, and it's very interesting. If you get somebody that's really getting to the point where they have pain and they're being out, what you got to do is say, okay, I got to change the way I think. I'm going to only do some of these exercises on one side of my body. I'm not going to do everything on both sides.
Right.
Because one side being one way and the other side being another way is what's causing the problem, and I have to do something to get that to go the other way. So it's pretty interesting to see all this stuff with, you know, the really extreme anterior pelvic tilt and where the, you know, the iliums are rotating outward and abducting outward. All this stuff you see with, like, sports hernia and pubalgia and all this stuff, it's not caused by skating. It's caused by their default posture, and then skating is exasperating that posture.
Do you think skating helped get them into that posture in the first place?
I think in general, our daily lives have helped us put us in that, and skating is probably really a small part of that, so it probably has contributed in a small way.
But the higher level players you see, it's a mechanical advantage, right?
The anterior pelvic tilt allows you to have a longer stride pushing behind you and sideways, so those guys tend to be faster. So it is, I don't think that skating caused it necessarily. The guys that have it have an advantage for playing the game, for being fast. And so they have kind of, in a roundabout way, been selected out as unnatural selection.
Yeah.
I think you'll see the same thing. Anybody that's a good sprinter has a lot of anterior tilt. Anybody that's fast in any sport has a lot of anterior tilt.
So you mentioned that there are things that it didn't necessarily, you know, have you investigating each guy, but there are things that you maybe have changed or you're going to avoid in season. Talk about a couple of those things, and I think this is the stuff you presented on, putting your presentation
some of,
in the clinic.
Some of it is stuff that I talked about in the clinic, and straight bar lifting is crappy, basically. We do cleans with a straight bar, we'll do some bench press with a straight bar, and some snatches with a straight bar, and then that's really it, because someone that's anteriorly tilted, their pelvis is rotated forward, their lumbar spine is extended forward. If you try to put a straight bar across their shoulders to do a squat, you're pushing them into more lumbar extension. You're facilitating the pattern that you really want to get them out of. And especially for, you know, good hockey players, a lot of the time tend to have relatively long arms. It gives them more reach and more range. So you think about a back squat position, how someone with long arms needs to be able to reach behind them to hold the bar on their shoulders. That's just giving them more extension. They have to compensate and push forward more to reach the bar in that position. You know, like we've talked about, anytime we load heavy squats, we're using kettlebells or trap bars or the Power Max super deadlift bars where their arms are down by their sides, where they're not trying to reach behind them.
Mm.
It's a much better, safer shoulder position.
Yeah, and you think about, like you said, you're just compressing into a worse spinal position,
right?
There. What about same issue with straight bar depth? Talk a little bit about the shear, the shearing force of somebody with an anterior pelvic tilt who's maybe deadlifting, or because we still see a lot of that, I think.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of programs out there that are basing a majority of their strength work on the big, you know, straight bar lifts like that. So,
yeah.
Talk a little bit about the deadlift and anterior pelvic tilt.
Yeah, they're the same thing. So basically, a deadlift and a back squat are the same, very similar body position as far as the joint angles and stuff. And when somebody is deadlifting with a straight bar, they need to basically lean forward over the straight bar, which as the more you lean forward, the more posterior shearing you're going to have in your spine. And so again, if you think about the posture you're in with, say, a trap bar or a Power Max super deadlift bar, instead of the weight being in front of you, your hands can be on your sides. So your torso is allowed to be more upright. The more vertical your spine is, the less shearing you're going to get. Which is, again, why I really like things like split squats and rear foot elevated squats. Because if one hip is flexed forward and the other hip is extended back, the upper body can be 100% vertical, completely perpendicular to the floor. And so almost all the stress on the spine is compression. There's almost no shearing.
Mm.
How often do you see somebody with a compression injury? Almost never.
Right.
Like a compression fracture is like, that's for people with osteoporosis and stuff like that. That's not for healthy, athletic people.
Or guys squatting 1,000 pounds or more.
Right. And again, same thing. When those guys are doing that, they're doing a back squat, so they're leaning forward. So to compound that, all that compression, they're also getting the shearing to go with it. So where if you're putting someone in a split squat position or a rear foot elevated squat position, that goes away. They're completely vertical.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, I think PRI sort of came out of the gates pretty hard there. Obviously, there were years and years and years in development, and then it blew up for a couple of years, and I think it's quieted down now, but there's still very useful stuff in there, and stuff that you can apply.
Yeah, I think it's not brand new anymore, so people don't talk about it, and I'm surprised how many people talk about it, and then when you really talk to them, they never actually took a course. And so it's like, well, you can go online and you can read somebody else's notes of what they did at the course, or somebody else's, you know, you can go online and get like PRI flashcards and stuff like that, but I'm not so sure that's the same as actually taking the course. It's kind of like when you were a kid, you ever played that game Telephone? Everybody sits in a line or a circle and the first person whispers a sentence in the next person's ear and you go all the way around. By the time it gets back, it's not the same sentence anymore. Like every person changed it a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of times that's what you see. So, I highly encourage people to actually take the course. You know, I've found it to be very interesting and very helpful, even though I'm not a therapist and I'm never going to be in a position where I'm doing lots of, you know, manual testing or manual therapy and testing and all this kind of stuff. There's still a lot to take away from it.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's the right approach, too. We've also sort of heard that the postural restoration is not strength and conditioning. So I think a lot of times people were trying to use it as strength and conditioning
right.
in their programs.
Right.
You know, like repping out some of those retro step ups and that kind of stuff where
yeah.
it's not really intended for that. But
yeah, it's not intended to be used that way. People are applying, you know, again, they're applying it the wrong way. It's the thing. It's just like, you know, the guys that are the CrossFit trainer or whatever. They know how to work out and they know how to do the exercises, but they don't know why. When you start looking at the why behind neuromuscularly about trying to increase the efficiency of the nervous system to turn on motor units, and we're trying to increase the number of fast twitch muscle fibers a guy has, then you start to wonder, why would you do 15 or 20 reps? Why would you only take 20 seconds rest between sets? Because from a physiological and neurological standpoint, no matter what exercises you're doing, that doesn't train the motor units that you want to use when you play ice hockey. So people know how, but they don't know why. And I think that's what you're starting to see. You know, the biggest thing missing out of most people's strength training program is the strength training. It's all corrective exercise. And I put corrective exercise in my programs, but again, you got to understand why you're doing it, not just how. And for me, the other problem with that, again, maybe it's because I always mostly work with teams and I have a group of 20-plus guys, but corrective exercises are the hardest things for the players to do the right way because it's correcting something that they do poorly. Mm. So you can only put so much of that in any given workout. You know, there's a finite amount of high learning curve stuff you can have in a training session. So in my opinion, the more corrective exercise you put in there, probably the crappier the guys are going to do at it. You know, I'd rather just do one or two things and do them really well and have the corrective exercise actually correcting the problem I'm trying to correct, as opposed to saying, yeah, I got a shitload of corrective exercises in here and I don't know if they really met the objective or not, because guys are doing 20 things that they weren't very good at.
Yeah. All right, well, let's wrap it up with that. And, yeah, this is kind of nice, just sort of a sit down here. But, guys, remember to head to the site, check it out. Remember, you can join us for just 7 days if you're not a member already. But if you are a member, we really appreciate you joining us and being a part of the community. And we'll try to keep bringing you great conversations like this. And so that's going to wrap up episode 61 of the Hockey Strength Podcast. We really appreciate you joining us. And Daryl, thanks for coming on.
Sure, you bet. Thanks for having me on.